I haven't had a Bible for 5 years. I've been praying for 5 years for my very own copy of the Word of God. This is the greatest gift anyone could ever ask for, the Word of God in my own language. And our mission really was born in the army bases in South Africa and Southwest Africa, in the war in Angola and Mozambique. But one of our most important mission fields in recent years has been Sudan. Since 1995, we've been working in Sudan. Some of you may have seen this picture before. It's a Pulitzer Prize photograph of 1994, taken 1993, but it won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994. South African photojournalist Kevin Carter took this photograph in Sudan. It's of a Sudanese girl, malnourished, starving and weak, with a vulture ominously in the background. Kevin Carter went to New York. He got the Pulitzer Prize, which is like the Academy Award of photojournalism. There's no higher award in photojournalism. And after he got the award, people asked him, what happened to the little girl in the picture? Well, I don't know, said Kevin Carter. Well, how do you get the picture? What's the story? Well, he said he had flown into Sudan the first time, his only time in Sudan. He was in just for 2 hours. He was about 300 meters from his aircraft on the airstrip, which was also feeding center for the UN, and he is looking for a photographic opportunity. And when he saw this little girl crawling and stumbling towards the village, he positioned himself in the shade of a tree. He focused up, he took a light reading and said, I had to wait an hour. But when this vulture hopped in the background, I clicked the shutter and I knew I had an award-winning picture. But what did you do after you took the picture? Well, said Kevin Codd, I sat under the tree, I smoked a cigarette, and I cursed God. This girl weighed less than his camera equipment. He could have carried her 300 yards to the aircraft. She could have flown out to neighboring Kenya, to the Red Cross Hospital, Lokochokyo. She could have been put in an IV drip. She might have survived. All Kevin Carter carried into Sudan was his cameras. All he carried out of Sudan was this picture. All he left behind in Sudan were cigarette stubs. When I look at this picture, I think of the words of the Lord Jesus. Whatever you did not do unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it to me. Christians are under fire in Sudan. We've been under fire in Sudan. I've ministered over 1,200 times in churches and schools in Sudan on 27 missions behind the lines there, sometimes spending months at a time in the field. I've never ministered in a school or a church that hasn't been bombed at least once. Some, like Fraser Cathedral here, was bombed 10 times in just a 12-month period. This church was a beautiful wooden and thatch Episcopal church, the pastor and his deacon standing in the ashes of what was a church, bombed by MiG-23s. This church was destroyed by helicopter gunships. Many churches have been destroyed for all kinds of different reasons all over Sudan. This church, Fraser Cathedral, is destroyed 3 times and rebuilt each time. Good hospitality in Sudan is to say, here's the air raid shelter, here's an AK-47. And so, quite different from Australian hospitality, where they show you where the bathroom is and where the fridge is and give you a towel. In Sudan, good hospitality is giving you an assault rifle and showing you where the bomb shelter is, which is necessary because exterior decorating by Muhammad and Sons, your home too can look like this. Phone 1-800-MUHAMMAD. In front of many of the churches, you will see graves of the missionaries who, like the seed that fell into ground and died, has produced 30, 60, 100-fold. Churches in Africa have been built upon the graves of many missionaries. This church I've ministered in more than probably any other church in Sudan, a church at Kotobi, destroyed by helicopter gunships. We were coming to run a leadership training Muslim evangelism workshop there, much like today's Muslim evangelism seminar. We arrived and the venue was destroyed. And the people gathered with a Christian flag in the ashes of their church, and they still wanted me to teach them how to win the enemies to Christ. Our conference continued actually out in the bush, in the forest, and people had to carry their own chairs there. And this is how conferences often be carried. How many people do you know would walk in 45-degree heat carrying their own chairs several kilometers when there's a chance they might get bombed by helicopter gunships while doing so? Rebuilding the church, and while we're rebuilding it, we rigged up a screen to show them the Ben-Hur film and also Khartoum, you know, Charlton Heston Khartoum on General Charles Gordon, final year, days of Khartoum. And one of the people came to me after and said, I think that Ben-Hur is also Gordon Pasha. I said, you're very perceptive, that's Charlton Heston, it's an actor. Now they were confused. Because, I mean, these things are separated about 1,800 years apart, and I was trying to explain how it's the same person in both roles. Many of these people don't see films. And when we finished building the church, it wasn't thatching season, no thatch. I had to have plastic roof, which is quite unbearable in the heat until the thatch was able to be harvested. But here's the church, rebuilt again. Just one of many hundreds of examples of churches destroyed by the Muslim persecution, rebuilt. To drive from Cape Town, South Africa, where our mission headquarters is, up to Sudan is 8,000 kilometers by road, one way. This is the border post of South Sudan. Immediately, you're confronted by a reminder that you're entering into one of the longest wars of the 20th century and 21st century. Here we passed 12 shot-out vehicles in what we call Ambush Alley, in just a 2 kilometer distance. Now, when you're driving in a soft-skinned vehicle and you see tanks haven't survived on these roads, it revolutionizes your prayer life. If you need to revolutionize your prayer life, go on a mission to a place like Sudan. You'll find it really directs your prayers and focuses your prayers no end. You'll do full repentance before you've traveled on those roads very far. And these are the kind of roads you travel on. This is an ambulance that we produced, bought in Cape Town, in Transvaal actually. We adapted it and drove it up to Sudan to get people from the battlefront to the hospital. The roads are often quite muddy. This is typical, and this is a typical Sudanese bridge. You can see the bridge has been blown up, so that's why we need the snorkel on the side of the engine, that the engine can breathe under water. I don't know if you use your four-wheel drives quite the same over here in Australia, but we can use our winch 18 times on a single mission in the field to get ourselves out of sticky, muddy, messy positions. We have a Christian flag often on our vehicle because we don't want to be the victims of friendly fire. It's bad enough being shot up by the enemy, but you don't want to be shot up by your own side. And most of the vehicles are in the hands of the Arabs, so we're really concerned about friendly fire. Most of the time, though, we're going to places we can't drive to, and we need to charter aircraft and fly in. We don't get these nice planes. That's what the UN uses. And we've got to watch out for these chaps, MiG-29 fighter jets and these horrible Hind helicopters, the Mi-24. These are what the Chinese government provide to the Muslim government of Sudan to shoot down planes like ours that are trying to get Bibles and aid into the resistance force areas. Can you see the helicopter gunship? That's a bit closer. Here it is. This is an Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunship machine gunning our team, strafing the team that was bringing Bibles and agricultural tools and seed medical equipment for the resistance fighters in the Nuba Mountains. I flew in this plane on an earlier time. This is another time. We weren't in the plane when it crashed. It wasn't too dramatic. It wasn't that they got shot down, just that they ran out of air strip before they ran out of air speed. And it's not going anywhere. These people were shot up along with our team when the Hind helicopter shot up the place. Here you can see a woman who lost her leg. What was left of her leg had to be amputated without anesthetic. Can you imagine having your leg amputated without anesthetic? The team fled up the mountainside and was taken under the protection of this SPLA, Sudanese People's Liberation Army Resistance Force, and they were taken for 120 kilometers onto the other side of the mountain. And after we managed to evacuate them, I prepared another aircraft to go in to take in relief aid. Here's the Bible in Arabic, contraband, illegal. 4 tons agricultural tools and seed, and Bibles and these 20-liter water containers. Absolute scorched earth campaigns being waged upon our Christian brethren in the Nuba Mountains. They're poisoning the wells, they're crucifying pastors. It's scorched earth. Everything necessary to sustain life is being destroyed. These people are destitute, often without clothes or food. James Cromer, who had his arm cut off by the Arabs. And this evangelist who had both his feet chopped off by the Arabs because they didn't want him taking the gospel to his neighbors. The Arabs have enslaved something like 1 million Nubians into what they call their peace camps. Children are separated from their parents. They're given Arabic names. They're forced to speak Arabic. They're beaten if they speak their own language. Forcibly Islamized and Arabized. Some of them will be trained to go and fight their own people. The valley used to be a beautiful, agriculturally rich, easy place to farm. But the Arabs have scorched earth it. So the people have now fled up the mountains, and the Christian resistance fighters, the SPLA, Sudanese People's Liberation Army, are fighting on the tops of the mountains. Beleaguered brethren, about 400,000 of them, are resisting the Arab attacks. Very stony, rocky, thorny, scorpion-ridden, ankle-twisting ground. And this is where entire divisions of Arab forces have disappeared, ineffectually, only able to re-equip, resupply the SPLA with a whole lot of weapons. As the people in the SPLA say, the enemy is my quartermaster. If they need anything, you get it from the enemy. And here you can see a Christian flag flying up on the mountain slopes. These people say, we've been fighting the Arabs, not just 50, 60 years like the Southerners. We Nubians, we've been fighting the Arabs for 1,400 years. And it's not much of an exaggeration. They say, my grandfather fought the Arabs. My great-grandfather fought the Arabs. My father fought the Arabs. I fight the Arabs. My sons are fighting the Arabs. One day, my grandsons will fight the Arabs. We will never bow to Mecca. There's that kind of resistance. And the Christian flag's flying on these mountains. And you think of Isaiah 18, it says, all the world will see when a banner is raised on the mountains. A trumpet will sound. All the world will hear it. All the world will see it. What could happen that's of worldwide significance in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, beyond the rivers of Ethiopia? Well, this is one of the, this Sudan was the longest running war of the 20th century, the largest country in Africa, not anymore. South Sudan's got its independence. But the Nuba Mountains, still up there in Sudan, behind enemy lines, an island of Christianity in a sea of Islam. It's one of the last countries to become Islamic. It could be one of the first countries in Africa to be freed from Islam. And in fact, South Sudan has already been, and now we work on Nuba Mountains. There's some very interesting things here. Most of the Christians in Sudan speak Arabic. Many come from a Muslim background. It can be a beachhead for liberating the Muslim Middle East from Islam. These people are Orthodox Coptic Christians. High up, 4,500 feet above sea level, their beautiful stone buildings been destroyed down the valley, so they've now fled up the mountain. In the Nuba Mountains, they expect the woman to carry all the heavy weight. And I always insist on carrying my own packs. And they say, no, no, you don't understand. This is our heritage. This is our culture. You're our guest. You've got to give us your pack. I can't give you my pack. You're going to give it to some teenage girl to carry. That would be a great disgrace to me. No, no, you don't understand. They say, that's why God made the girls, to carry the heavy weights. Well, that doesn't convince me. I'm still trying to teach them about chivalry. But we carry our own weights. The Arab government has put death threats on us. They've said that I should expect to be shot on sight, bombed every time I come to the Nuba Mountains. They put price on our heads. We've got to change direction and change our location every night, keep moving. It's a very lunar landscape type terrain in many cases. But we work and walk behind the lines and show the Jesus form. This is Jesus form kit. Now, before we moved on to video projectors, solar panels, which is great. Now it takes a 20 kilogram backpack and you got the whole thing. But this was about 160 kilograms with the fuel, the generator, 60 millimeter projector. That was old technology. But notice how the women have all the heavy weights. That's like a 30 kilograms of weight for the generator on the lady's head. And we'd be showing the people the first film many of them have ever seen. And while we're showing them films, you'd see tracers lighting up the sky. Crumps of mortars, rattle of machine guns, sometimes a parachute flare, just reminding us that we're in the middle of one of the longest wars still raging in the 21st century. You can see the 16mm projector just balanced on the back of that rock. This is not a drive-in, this is a walk-in. Notice how the people like their third leg, the hike with a hiking stick, which I found very useful, especially on a descent, especially in the dark, balance and all that. And so they've won me over to the idea of hiking with a hiking stick these days. Many of the people said, it's the first time I've ever seen a full. Some of the children screamed when they saw us and ran screaming, like they'd seen a monster. And the parents would say, excuse our children. We have seen white people before, but our children have never. And you can imagine the impact of seeing these films. One thing that most of you would have seen the cheese film, when the scene of the snake appears early on, get our people to stand around and project and protect it because they scramble, they flee, that just like rolling waves as the kids scream and try and get away from the screen. They're not used to the media. And to see a snake so close up. We smuggle in Bibles. I've been involved in getting 500,000 Bibles and Christian books in 25 languages into Sudan, about 14 regions. Generally, we use a Cessna Caravan. Chartered aircraft can take about a ton in at a time. This is the biggest aircraft we can charter. It's a DC-3, can carry 3 tons in. This is what our ancestors jumped out of at Arnhem in Normandy in the Second World War. I jumped out of them too in Angola. In South East Africa, we have South African Army still using them. This is an ex-South African Air Force DC-3 turboprop conversion, an ex-South African Air Force pilot, by the way, too. And that's the ambulance that we drove up from the Transvaal from South Africa. 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments in 30 languages on the airstrip there. The largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled into an officially Islamic country, as far as I know. And I would have liked 10,000, but we had on this team also Pat Matrician and his film crew, who produced the Sudan Hidden Holocaust film on this. So each person displaced about 100 kilograms. So that meant we were the 300 Bibles short that would have made us a neat 10,000, which had been my hope. The first 3,000 Bibles in the Moro language delivered to the church that will not die, the Fraser Cathedral, where they're regularly bombed in Sudan. To put the Bible in the people's hands is a great challenge. The man who translated the Bible into the Moro language died in ambush with the Arabs on the way to get it printed back in 1991. Here is the Bible which we managed to get it printed, delivered into South Sudan to the very area. This is where the Bible translator Ezra Lawiri was killed in an ambush with the Arabs back in 1991. In the year 2000, we were coming back with the Bibles that he had translated. Running an evangelism explosion training program with a team from America that Dr. James Kendi had lent to me, and delivering a whole lot of good equipment. And on the Sunday morning, as we were running through the EE program, if you were to die tonight, do you know for sure that you're going to heaven? The cry went up, Antonos, and the people poured out of the church. And I was the slowest to get out of the church because a plane flying overhead doesn't mean you're going to get bombed. I mean, false alarms happen all the time. And I'd had many of these false alarms, so I let everyone go first, and I was the last out. And as I came out of the church, I heard the high-pitched screaming of the bombs. See, the thatch is so thick, it actually deadens the sounds, and the screaming of people also did. I only heard the sounds of the bombs as I stepped out, and it was so loud, so intense, I knew I didn't have a chance to get to the trenches, I didn't have time to take another step, just to lie flat, and suddenly the ground shook, our ears popped, huge pillars of fire and clouds and shrapnel hissing all through. And at that moment, I remembered what my parents told me had gone through the Second World War. Open your mouth, put your hands over your ears if you can, but open your mouth to equalize the pressure so you don't have your eardrums burst. And my father saying, whatever goes up is going to come down. How he had to tilt his helmet to cover the back of his neck because everything that went flying up would come pummeling down. And that's what I was thinking of at that moment, what my parents had told me, and experiencing that kind of bombardment. 5 1,000-kilogram bombs were dropped in and around the church area. I got up to try and help the people, and then another 3 bombs came down on us, and here we are with some of the shrapnel. In fact, if you come to our mission headquarters, Livingston House in Cape Town, we have these shrapnel pieces on display, ornaments, paperweights, and so on. 8 1,000-kilogram bombs were dropped in an area the size of a football field. All of them within 100-meter radius, some as close as 17 meters. I got cracked ribs as a result. But nobody died. 300 people in church that day. The trees were full of shrapnel, but we were not. It doesn't really make sense. Not only did we not lose anyone, we gained people. The service continued. It lasted 5 hours in total. We had more people in the service after the bombing than before. How many churches do you know? How many churches in Australia would carry on the service after a bombing? We not only carried on the service, it lasted more than 3 hours afterwards. And the highlight was producing the Bible, presenting the Bible, the first Bible in their language, the Moro language, to the community with a Bible translator lie buried. And remind them of William Tyndale, who died at the stake, burned alive for the crime of translating the Bible to English. The first Bible printed into English had to be translated in Germany, printed in Germany, smuggled into Britain from the Netherlands, and they were all burned. 6,000 New Testaments destroyed by order of the Bishop of London because they were in English. Only two survived. One was sold recently for £5.4 million. One Bible, one New Testament. One of the first of the New Testaments done by William Tyndale. Only two survived. Well, people came from far and wide. Soldiers came to see the church. It was bombed but still stood. We finished the EE clinic that week. There was still a chance that the bombers might come back, but we continued. And here's the chaplains, pastors, teachers. And here's one of the trees that was blown over, bombed in the bombing. Trees were full of shrapnel. We were not. This chaplain said, this happened to show the power of God. The Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. And this is another time, another place. If this bomb had gone off, it would have taken where we're meeting off the map, the church and the compound. Jesus Christ is building his church, and the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. Now, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray to the Lord the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest field. This is showing from where missionaries are sent out. And the light section, missionaries sent to their own culture or near culture in their country, and then the dark red going to another culture elsewhere. So this is giving an idea of missionaries that come from America, from Britain, from India, from North Korea, from Australia, South Africa, Brazil, primary missionary sending countries. This shows you the comparative growth of the church over the years. So you can see here, the yellow represents Christianity, the green represents Islam. Here is the percentage of the world's population on the left. At the bottom, the centuries, from the first century to the 21st century where we are now. You can see how Christianity is on an exponential graph going up, 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 and it started to plateau before Islam came. Islam in some ways is a judgment on the church for slackening off, getting backslidden, not getting as involved in missions. Islam in many ways is not just an attack on a church, it's a judgment on the church. Notice how Christianity declined from the time Islam came. Well, for one reason is they killed half of all the Christians in the world, actually. You see the growth of Islam going dramatically up, but the Black Death and then the Crusades brought Islam down dramatically. And then slow growth, but you can see their main growth has been since the First and Second World War. Notice Christianity rising and then falling a lot down because of the Mongol invasions in particular, wiping out a lot of Christians. But the growth and then tremendous growth in the 19th century, exponential growth. But then the world wars bring us down and then we are barely growing now. So basically, that's a quick overview of 2,000 years history of Christianity and Islam compared. Islam is not just one denomination. In fact, there are thousands of Islamic denominations, but most fall under the Sunni category. Now, the Sunnis are sort of like our Protestants. It's the book that matters to them, the Quran. The Shia are like our Catholics. It's the Ayatollah, it's the leader, it's the hierarchy. And then you get the others like the Sufis, which are somewhat like the Pentecostals. They're the sword-swallowing, fire-breathing, miracle a day keeps the devil away type. So you've got the Sufis, which are more charismatic. You've got the Shias, who are more structural, follow the leader. And you've got the Sunnis, who are more concerned about what the book says. That's the rough three divisions, but it breaks down to thousands, even tens of thousands of different distinctive type of denominations within Islam, actually. Now, here is somebody's attempt to see what percentage of Muslims are radical Islamicist terrorist sympathizers committed to jihad. And that's the dark red below. Notice you'd be in the other. I believe Australia's probably on the other, from what I can see. Still got quite a lot, though. Here you can see countries that are Islamic, and you can see again from, is it a Shiite republic like Iran or and Azerbaijan, or in the case of Bahrain, it's Sunni, and so on and so forth. So most of the wars in the Muslim Middle East today are battles between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and sometimes the Sufis. Here you can see the countries of the largest Muslim population. Notice, it may surprise you, the country with the largest amount of Christians in the world in 1900, Muslims, was India. But of course, Pakistan broke away. Notice, it then became Indonesia in 1950, year 2000, Indonesia's on top. 2000, India had 168 million Muslims in year 2000. But Indonesia is about to be overtaken by India and Pakistan, who will have 230 million and 291 million Muslims, respectively. So the way we're heading, most of the Muslims in the world are actually in Asia, and you can see how the Arab world is not where most of the population of Islam is, even though it's sometimes the most radical. Muslims were 12% of the world's population in 1900, about 200 million people. In 1950, they had grown. There was 400,000 Muslims in the world, 14% of the world's population. By the year 2000, Muslims had grown to 1.3 billion people, 21% of the world's population. If present trends continue, there's reason to believe they won't, but if they do, if we have a world population of 9 billion in 2050, Muslims could be 2.5 billion population and 27% of the world's population. So right now they're 1 in 5, they're heading towards 1 in 4 of the world's population, if present trends continue. Here you can see the yellow shows the percentage of Christians, the green the percentage of Muslims, and then the grey other. And you can see now, looking at, for example, the Malays and Indonesians, just how many Muslims there are versus other Malays and so on, sub-Saharan Africa. So you get a bit of an idea of where the Muslims are the huge majority, mostly the Arab world and the Muslim Middle East and Persia. Those areas where the serious majority. Here you can see by the darkness of the green where Muslims are the majority of the population. Plainly, Indonesia is your closest neighbor with a vast Muslim population, and they've got the largest number of Muslims of any country in the world at this moment, about 168 million. And again, you get the idea of where the Muslim distribution is. But this here has the size of the green block, not the size of the country geographically, but the size of the nation in terms of the population. And you can see Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, colossally big, whereas the countries you might have thought were really important, Libya and so on, are very, very small little blocks. So this is an interesting population size of nations to give you a better idea of where Islam is and where it has a major impact. The red dots represent where there are wars, and the size of the dots tells you the percent, the amount of people being killed. So wherever Islam is large, there's quite a bit of war. Where are Muslims going as refugees? United States, Russia, Germany, France, Saudi Arabia, Canada, and so on. Australia's down below. You've got a population of immigrants, 4 million, and the Muslims at this stage, they say, are 2.2% of all migrants in Australia, according to this chart. That's what it says. And foreign-born migrants over here too. Okay, considering evangelizing Muslims, I think it would also be important for me to give you an idea of the role of women. Women are a very neglected mission field in Islam, and few people understand the plight of women. If you've read or seen the film on Not Without My Daughter, the book is better, but you'll have a little understanding. The Quran instructs Muslims to marry women of your choice, two or three or four, but if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with them, only one or any slave girl you may own. Surah 4, verse 3. Here Muhammad authorizes and recommends polygamy, two or three or four. And then almost as an afterthought, Muhammad says, You can have monogamy. I mean, you could have just one wife. For those males, you might have some kind of personality disorder that prevents them from handling more than one wife at a time. Muhammad's policy seems to be polygamy for the strong and monogamy for the weak. That's the philosophy being promoted in the Quran. The Quran expressly permits sexual relations with multiple wives, even with slave girls, whom your right hand possesses. Surah 70. The Quran also assures slave owners who force the slave girls into prostitution that if anyone compels them, yet after such compulsion is Allah oft forgiving, trivializing sexual oppression. Christians reject polygamy because it inhibits, in fact, it exterminates exclusive devoted love. Love between a man and a woman ought to be exclusive, otherwise it's degraded in essence to mere physical lust. No woman who loves her husband and wishes to be fully loved in return can tolerate another wife. Muhammad attacked caravans for loot. He had over 600 Jewish men in Medina dig their own graves before slaughtering them, and their wives and children were sold as slaves. All of this is recorded in the Hadith. Monogamy, one man, one woman for life, gives recognition, status, and value to a woman. The Lord Jesus taught that Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. Jesus taught at the beginning the Creator made the male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. If Muhammad came to confirm the teachings of the Lord Jesus, as he claimed, as the final prophet, why did he undermine this principle of one man and one woman for life? And why did he make divorce in Islam so much easier? A mere verbal pronouncement, much harder than any of the Old Testament prophets had ever tolerated. They required written legal procedures and documents. Muhammad had at least 16 wives and 2 concubines. Muhammad's successor, Caliph Umar, married 7 women and had 2 slave girls as concubines. The Caliph Uthman married 8 women. The Caliph Ali, to whom Muhammad had denied permission to marry a second wife besides his own daughter, Fatima, after her death, he married 10 wives and maintained 19 slave girls as his concubines. Muhammad's grandson, Hassan, of whom Muhammad declared he is the master of the youth of paradise, married 70 women, had at least 31 children that we know of. According to Bukhari in the Hadith, Muhammad had sex with all his wives in a single night, and Muhammad boasted he had been given the power of 40 men. This is some kind of pervert. Muhammad is quoted in the Hadith as declaring, "Do not ask a husband why he beats his wife. According to the same principle, do not ask a husband why he takes a second wife." And so, basically, the men can do whatever they want in Islam, according to Sharia law. Muhammad also authorized temporary marriages for 3 nights or more. Temporary marriages? This is not even an affair. This is less. These could be contracted for some money, for a dress, or a handful of dates, some fruit. Thereafter, the husband could desert his wife without any obligation, and she had no rights, even with regard to any offspring that might come from the relationship, would have no claim for inheritance or support. And he called those temporary marriages. Muslim women are not allowed to marry non-Muslim men, but Muslim men are encouraged to marry Christian women. Result, Islam grows in number, because the husband always has control of the children. By approving of polygamy and mistresses and temporary marriages, Islam denies the value of a genuine marriage based on exclusive lifelong love. It erodes the concept of a biblical family. Monogamy, one man, one woman for life, alone gives recognition, status, and value that a woman needs. Only monogamy gives the stability for raising children in the fear of the Lord. And although many Muslims are self-congratulatory about Islam's toleration and treatment of women, Muhammad once said to a group of women, "I've not seen anyone more deficient in religion and intelligence than you. It is not the evidence of 2 women equal to the evidence of 1 man. Isn't it true that a woman can neither pray nor fast during a menstrual period? This is the deficiency in your religion." So he's openly derogatory. He was a misogynist, to put it nicely. The Caliph Ali declared, women are evil. Men never ever obey your women. Never let them advise you in any matter concerning your daily life. This is a picture sequence in Iran of a woman accused of being raped, and therefore she was hung. Because according to the Ayatollahs, a woman has the power of seduction and enticement, therefore she is 90% to blame in a rape, and she's the one who gets hung. Caliph Omar ordered Muslims to prevent women from learning to read and write and to resist their capricious ways. The Caliph Omar once rebuked his wife for interrupting conversation, saying, you are a toy. If you are needed, we will call you. Muhammad taught that a woman is arat. When she goes outside the house, the devil welcomes her. To Muhammad, women need to cover themselves with a veil, not to preserve their own chastity, but to preserve the chastity of the men prone to be scandalized by the spectacle. It's always the woman's fault. Nothing is the man's fault when you get down to it. I mean, what kind of picture is this? Some things can't be covered. Now, you know, in the Quran, a woman is required to cover her hair with a scarf. This veil covering the face business is actually fairly new. And I believe the main reason is to cover physical abuse, because you've got laws in Australia against wife beating or throwing acid in people's face. Muhammad forbade women to talk except by the permission of their husbands. Women were forbidden to use the middle of the road to be greeted or to greet. The fire worshipper, the Jew, and the pig are listed alongside women as what corrupts prayer. If a woman walks in front of a man while he's praying, his prayer is not acceptable. He then has to perform ablutions again, fully clean himself, change his clothes and so on, and repeat his prayer. In Islam, physical violence against your wife is not a crime punishable by law. It remains divinely ordained and practically advised, Surah 38, 44, Surah 4, 15, for example. As to those women on whose party fears disloyalty and ill conduct, admonish them first. Next, refuse to share their beds. Last, beat them lightly. And if they return to obedience, seek not against them means of annoyance, Surah 4, 34. Even in Islamic councils in Western countries, they advise how to beat your wives. For example, Australian Minaret, published by the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils, declared, the weapon of a woman is her femininity. Therefore, beating her is her remedy. So the Quranic command, banish them to the couches and beat them, agrees with the latest psychological findings and understanding of the rebellious woman. This is one of the scientific miracles of the Quran, because it sums up volumes of the science of psychology about rebellious women. This from an Australian Muslim council, how to beat your wives. And this woman had her nose cut off by her husband. Now here's a man kicking a woman who's holding a baby in her arms on the ground. Yeah, I mean, here you can see the respect for women. This woman on the left was, that's what she looked like before being beaten by her husband. She is a radio personality in Saudi Arabia. And her husband beat her so badly, she got these pictures published in order to show what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Ahmed Ahmad, in Individual Guarantee in the Islamic Law, writes, if admonishing and sexual desertion fails to bring forth results, and the woman is of a cold and stubborn type, the Quran bestows on a man the right to straighten out by rites of punishment and beating, providing he does not break her bones or shed her blood. Wow. There's some kind of restriction there. When your wife belongs to this quarrelsome type and requires the sort of punishment to bring her to her senses by the scourging, which deters, that's whipping. Pull her by the ear, beat her by hand or stick. It might be necessary to restrain her with strength or even threaten her. And there's all kinds of things about the right of woman to beat her because she must fulfill his desires and not allow herself to be untidy. She should beautify herself for him. This is from a gift for the Muslim couple. Washington Times, in an article entitled Sale of Children Thrives in Pakistan, reports that children as young as 5 years old are auctioned off to the highest bidder. How can you have laws against pedophilia in a Muslim country if Muhammad had a wife at age six? And so, as Muhammad's example of perfection, They can't have statutory rape or laws against paedophilia in Muslim countries because Muhammad did it, therefore it's good, right? These Afghan girls are sold for between $80 and $100 and generally land up in prostitution harems. Bukhari 6 speaks of Muhammad taking a bath with the little girl and fondling her. This is his wife from age 6 on, Aisha. In most Western countries, we've got a word for it, paedophilia. Islam regards women as possessions who can be bought and sold. This is against Western Christian civilized standards. And therefore, this talking like Sharia law is something we should respect and allow to be compatible. In Canada, they're allowing Sharia law to be used inside Canada for Muslim families. This means they take all the Charter of Rights of a woman in Canada and throw it in the trash and let Sharia law take supersedence. So a Muslim woman in Canada no longer has the protection of their Charter of Rights, just for example. Then there's the subject of female mutilation, which is absolutely horrific. And this is going on throughout the Muslim world, and it's being reported even by the US State Department on the practice in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, how women are discouraged from participating in politics, and women play no formal role in government. That's US politics ways of trying to make it sound nicer than it actually is. The government does not keep statistics on spousal abuse or other forms of violence against women, which appear to be common problems. Hospital workers report that many women are admitted for treatment of injuries that apparently result from spousal abuse. They can't say it because, I mean, the law's against them. Women are not admitted to a hospital for medical treatment without the consent of a male relative. Women may not undertake domestic or foreign travel alone. In public, a woman is expected to wear an abaya, a black tent, basically, covering her from head to toe. Daughters receive only half the inheritance awarded to brothers. Some women participate in what is called short daytime visit marriages, in which the woman relinquishes the legal rights to financial support and nighttime cohabitation. This is the US State Department's report on Saudi Arabia. Additionally, the husband is not required to inform his other wives of the marriage, and any children resulting from such marriage have no inheritance rights. Men may divorce without giving cause. In addition, women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to drive cars, although I believe that's changing this year. Divorced foreign women are prevented from visiting their husband, their children. Children are always awarded to the husband or to the deceased husband's family. All these laws in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia are based upon Islamic Sharia law. And there's reports continually of, for example, Pakistan, of this poor girl who gets stoned to death. She'd been raped by her husband's brother. The judge defended awarding her the death penalty because he said that the Quran mandates the death penalty for her because she has the power of enticement, therefore it must have been her fault that she was raped. Buried up to waist, stoned to death. Sharia law. Here's another woman, Zafran Bibi, who was raped, and she accused her brother-in-law of raping her, and this, he said, is a confession of having intercourse outside of marriage, and this fits a familiar pattern. Women are stoned to death in Muslim countries for being victims, or being hung in the case of the 16-year-old girl, or shot in the head in Afghanistan during halftime in the football match, stoned to death while strapped to a pillar in Iraq, crucified in Armenia, 1915. ATV and PBS were about to air a documentary, Death of a Princess, on the execution of a Saudi Arabian princess who converted to Christ, and they were brought under extraordinary pressure by the British Foreign Office, the US State Department, the Saudi royal family, and oil companies to cancel the show. So much for independent television. They cancelled the show. They made this, and they couldn't broadcast it. There's bizarre examples of Islamic justice. I mean, if people want to say, you can't call it backward, you can't suggest that Western justice is better or that our standards are better. Yes, you can. Take this example. Here's a male youth had been seen walking with a girl from another tribe. Walking. The local tribal council quoted Sharia law and decided to punish the young boy by decreeing that his 18-year-old sister be gang raped by them in punishment for what she had done. What he had done. She hadn't done anything, but she gets gang raped as the judicial sentence to punish her brother for walking with another girl of another tribe. How can one say that all religions are equal or all systems of justice are equal? Muslim men in Indonesia gang raping dozens of Chinese women in homes and shops screaming Allah Akbar. This is quoted in Don Richardson's Secrets of the Quran book, which is one big eye-opener. And then you get this Kurdish refugee from Iraq who's jailed in England for slitting the throat of a 16-year-old daughter because she has two westernized and had a non-western boyfriend. This is what they call honor murders. There's a lot of honor murders, a lot. In fact, there are thousands of honor murders in Europe every year, from Sweden to Germany, France, Britain. Murdered by their families because they have disgraced them in some way or another, or burned alive in Afghanistan. Afghan women set themselves now alight, and this is common now as a protest against how badly they're treated. I mean, burning has got to be the worst way to die. Why would a person do this to themselves? And this is common. A local human rights group spoke about 56 people have set themselves ablaze in Herat, a city in West Afghanistan, just in the past year. All of them were young, married, or soon to be married women, and there was even a bride-to-be of 13 years old. This is very problematic. We talk about hundreds of women igniting themselves in Afghanistan every year. And there's a lot of examples of this. They said not a village in the province where a young woman has not burnt herself to death. This is Rania Albaz, who allowed newspapers to show pictures of a swollen, disfigured face in order to highlight domestic abuse in Saudi Arabia. Her husband, Mohammed Al-Falata, beat her so hard he broke her nose, fractured her face in 13 places. He is not punished in Saudi Arabia. He broke no law in Saudi Arabia. It is considered a husband's right that his wife should obey him. This can involve coercion or violence. We know the majority of these cases go unreported and unnoticed. One of the strange times when BBC actually reported something. There's all kinds of brutality of Sharia law. And when a police woman was asked to arrest a man who had stabbed his wife for disobeying him, she asked what would happen to the husband, and the reply was nothing. Men are kings here. And later, this police woman who tried to arrest him was killed by the Taliban. Here's a 29-year-old Zahida Parveen, Pakistani 29-year-old mother of three, was disfigured. Her husband attacked her. He cut off her ears, her tongue, and her nose, and he gouged out her eyes. Now, by God's grace, she has had surgery and been able to recover to some degree. But there was a fire in a school in Mecca where every window was covered with iron bars and every door was locked. And as the girls tried to escape through a locked door, the Muslim police converged on the scene, forced the girls back into the burning building because they weren't properly dressed in the proper obligatory abaya. 15 girls were trampled to death and 40 were injured in this incident. I mean, imagine if something like this had happened in Australia. There is so much example where you blame the victim. This is very much the way Islam regularly puts themselves in the victim stage, and instead of being the villains, they're always the victims, and the people are the victims, and they make them the villains. It's a common tendency here. And so there's a whole lot of books like Jan Goodwin's one on Price of Honor, Muslim Woman, Lift the Veil of Silence on the Islamic World. The abuse, which they dare not report, because they will be punished if they report the abuse. And there's a lot, but I don't need to carry on, but there's this example on the bus saying, well, it's the girl's fault that she is raped. She's wearing a skirt, not a hijab. What was she doing working? She should have been at home. And so Muslim men regard themselves as not responsible to exercise restraint because the woman is always responsible not to tempt them. And thousands of Western women have complained of being groped, jeered, assaulted, insulted by Muslim men in the Middle East. This is common. This is just another girl murdered by their father's, brother's, uncles. And there's a whole family wiped out. And here's the man and his wife being arrested for this murder of his children. And yet you've got people like this in Britain calling for Sharia law for Britain. I bet you've got people calling for Sharia law in Australia. Behead those insult the Prophet, which would include people like me. And I've got so many death threats accumulated for teaching Muslim evangelism and loving your Muslim neighbor enough to give them the gospel. They don't want you to be able to be critical. People can say anything against God and Christ and attack Christianity, and we don't want to attack them. We don't even start lawsuits against them. We believe in freedom of speech. But the way, the moment we try to speak out to try and rescue Muslims from abuse and slavery, next thing we know, they want to throw death threats on everyone. Now this man, Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, had over 200 wives, but he was a good Muslim because he had never had more than four wives at a time. This 72-year-old Malaysian policeman had his 52nd wedding, but he said, I'm not a playboy, because he's never had more than four wives at a time. Divorce is simple in a Muslim country. This man said he's a good Muslim, he never had more than four wives at a time, and his marriages have lasted an average 193 days each, so you know, he's capable of having a good balance. One of his marriages lasted 20 years. I think we should give him a medal for that. So getting stoned in Australia doesn't mean the same thing as a girl getting stoned in Afghanistan. Taking shots in Afghanistan is not the same thing as taking shots in Australia. Gay guys hanging out in Australia is not the same thing as gay guys hanging out in Iran. There's all kinds of cultural differences, but we need to care enough to reach out to the broken hearts and those whose spirits have been crushed. There's a lot of evil going on in the world, and you can see a Sharia stan covering a whole lot of North Africa that used to experience a lot more freedom. And the worst of this is coming into schools, maybe in your country, because it's already in Denmark and places like that, where they're starting to indoctrinate children, take them on field tours, forcing them to dress like Muslims, and Sharia the future. Democracy is the cancer, Islam is the answer. Do you think Islam is the answer to your problems in Australia? Can you guess what their agenda is? And yet they've got fatwa councils, legal advice centers, and the Quran should be the highest authority because Islam must be the only acceptable religion on earth. The degrading and deplorable abuse of women in Islam should excite the outrage of every women's rights group, every feminist worldwide. But inexplicably, this isn't the case. Why is it that you're not allowed to talk about these subjects? Why is it that the abuse of women in the Muslim world is not allowed to be brought up in our schools, our universities, our parliaments, or even in our newspapers? The influence of Islam paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world, said Winston Churchill. In one picture, the state of the world is, in the east, the face is covered, and eyes can see. In the west, the eyes are covered so that we don't see. That's what we're dealing with. A Muslim who kills a dozen infidels is okay, but a Christian who mentions God in public, he's shoving religion down people's throats. Should be stopped, should be arrested. If a religion promotes killing non-believers, beating women, punishing rape victims, selling daughters or wives, they're not praying to the God above, but to the God below. Never take your freedoms for granted. The disgraceful abuse of women in Islam is a taboo subject in most Western circles, maybe because Islam's frivolous view of marriage is closer to the permissiveness of the humanists than the Christian principles of a wife being the husband's closest and most intimate companion, lifelong marriage partner, and best friend. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your daughters, your wives, and your homes. It's serious. We should stop Islamization. It's Islamization or reformation. Truth is a new hate speech. During a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. But silence in the face of evil is itself evil. We've got a leaflet, an article, Christian Liberation of Women. I've seen Muslims in hijabs in Cape Town coming up to us. Do you have that Christian Liberation woman taking it under black cloaks and disappearing off with it to want to read? You can only imagine what these poor people go through. But the passion of the Christ film was shown throughout the Muslim world to overflowing theatres. Never before has any Christian medium impacted the lives of tens of millions of Muslims. Missionaries in the Middle East have rejoiced that more people have seen the passion of the Christ in a single day in the Middle East than they've been able to show the Jesus film to in years of full-time missionary work. The Jesus film is illegal in most Muslim countries. It can only be shown secretly at great risk. In fact, Heather Mercer, an American missionary who's been in our mission, was arrested in Afghanistan and sentenced to death in 2001 for showing four Muslims the Jesus film. She was only rescued by American Special Forces, praise God. But the passion is being openly screened in shopping mall centers. Why? Because the press in the West said that the passion of the Christ is anti-Semitic, and that's like the stamp of approval in a Muslim country. They all want to see something that's called anti-Semitic, which it isn't. But the point is, it's interesting how the Western media shot themselves in the foot because they made the passion a curiosity that all Muslims now want to see it. Then there's Satellite 7. How many have heard of Satellite 7? Sat 7 is the most phenomenal media missionary project to Muslims. I remember 28 years ago, perhaps, as on the ship off the coast of South Africa, hyper-secret Muslim ministry mobilization network plan. George Verver was part of it. We were discussing how to reach the Muslim Middle East with the gospel. And somebody came up with Satellite 7, the goal of reaching Muslims through satellite television. And I was the first to speak. I said, well, how many Muslims have access to satellite TV? Well, 28 years ago, the man said, 50 million. 50 million? And I said, are you telling me the Bedouins have satellite dishes on their camels? He said, as a matter of fact, yes, they do. And Sat7 has been a phenomenal runaway success. They are broadcasting the gospel in Arabic, Farsi, Turkish, and they've got a children's program 24 hours a day. Phenomenal response. And there's more Muslims tuning in now than ever before. They can't keep up with the tens of thousands of correspondences they get every month. It's tremendous. There's a lot of secret Muslims in the Muslim Middle East downloading Bibles, downloading Bible apps, downloading Bible studies. Pray for the Muslim world. Realize there is media there involved. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are seriously few. Let us pray the Lord of the harvest to thrust out workers into his harvest field, and we must reach out to our neighbors who could be right next door.